This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, can the Trump administration revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. U.S. President Donald Trump believes he can jumpstart talks between Israelis and Palestinians through the good offices of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. In early May, he hosted Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at the White House and said, quote, "We want to create peace between Israel and the Palestinians. We will get it done. I think there is a very good chance, and I think we will," unquote, from President Donald Trump. Meantime, a crisis was recently diffused in Jerusalem over security measures in relation to the compound that is revered by Jews as the Temple Mount and by Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary, or Haram al-Sharif. The crisis began on July 14th with the murder of two Israeli policemen and the subsequent killing of the gunman by Israeli forces. Israel then installed metal detectors and metal archways supporting cameras and railings at the site after this incident, but they sparked widespread protests among Arabs who said Israel was possibly using the measures to control the site. Later, Israel removed the remaining security measures in a move that appeared aimed at ending the standoff that had piled political pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, for more on the crisis averted and prospects for jumpstarting peace talks, we have two distinguished analysts. Natan Sachs is director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a think tank here in Washington. His work focuses on Israeli foreign policy, domestic politics, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and U.S.-Israeli relations. He's currently writing a book on Israeli grand strategy and its domestic origins. And Greif Alomari, he's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. Previously, he served in various advisory positions with the Palestinian Authority, including advisor to the negotiating team during the 1999 to 2001 permanent status peace talks. And Gaith Alomari joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
And Natan, I was just about to get to you. Welcome to you from a studio at Brookings Institution.
Thanks so much.
Well, let me begin with Gaith Alomari here in the studio. Just briefly about this Temple Mount / Haram al-Sharif dispute, Gaith Alomari, it has been resolved. How do you read this? What's the upshot?
First of all, it has been resolved with the unfortunate loss of many lives in the process. So to me, there are two lessons that I have learned from this tension. One, the issue of Jerusalem, particularly the issue of the Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, is so sensitive that it has to be approached with extra care, extra sensitivity. Things that make sense in other contexts and in other locations do not make sense in the Temple Mount. And therefore, we have to be very careful when dealing with it. Otherwise, we will not only ignite nationalist emotions, but also religious emotions, and that's very dangerous. Second thing is looking at the way that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian President, dealt with it. These are leaders who were not leading. These are leaders who were trying to read their public opinions and to respond to the public opinion. And as such, we saw a vacuum of leadership. If these kind of leaders are unable to lead in a limited crisis, it's very hard to imagine how they will lead in a larger peace process.
Turning to you, Natan Sachs, it stands to logic that Israel would want to do something up the security measures after the killing of the two Israeli policemen. At the same time, what about Gaith Alomari's point that what seems reasonable in any normal circumstance is somehow different when it comes to Jerusalem and the so-called Temple Mount or Haram al-Sharif?
I think Gaith put it very well. I think in Jerusalem, a lot of things make sense. After an attack by two Israeli citizens, actually, Palestinian citizens of Israel, on the Temple Mount, Israel stepped up security measures there. And even if you consider Israel an occupying force in the region, of course Israelis don't, security is its responsibility. But what would make sense in another context doesn't here. And by the way, it's not just Jews and Muslims in this regard. If you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and you look up and to the right just before you enter, you'll see a ladder that's been there for well over 100 years. And that ladder cannot be moved because of disagreements between the different Christian churches that govern the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And that ladder, the arrangements on Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, all this is part of the status quo of religious affairs in Jerusalem. So while logically a lot of things could be done very differently, the sensitivity of everything here, the emotive power of religious conflict that can overtake a national conflict, all this points on the side of caution, where both leaders should be very, very cautious. But, of course, caution means more than just passivity. Caution means that you have to get ahead of affairs, you have to lead, like Reis said, and you also have to be very responsible with how you deal with things. When one side does something in that site, it is incumbent on the other not to use that for political gain, not to inflame things further. And unfortunately, we see it time and again, not only among Israelis and Palestinians, but in the region more generally. Anything to do with the site is seen as some grand Israeli plan to take over this site. 50 years, apparently, Israel's been trying and failing to do. And everything to do with the Palestinians is immediately seen as some great religious war against Israelis. And calmer leaders would do well to try and steer things towards the rational and the national narrative of a conflict, which is hard enough already, away and away from the religious aspects, especially regarding Jerusalem, where so many emotions run high.
Indeed. We're going to get to the leaders, Abbas and Bibi Netanyahu, in just a minute. But first, let me ask you here in the studio, Gaith Alomari, to what extent this incident may have strained relations between Israel and Jordan, and why is Jordan so important in this case?
I mean, it certainly did. Jordan sees itself as the custodian of the holy sites in Jerusalem, a status that was recognized by Israel in the Israel-Jordan peace treaty, and later on by the Palestinians in a Jordanian-Palestinian treaty. Accordingly, Jordan has to step in. Now, Jordan tried to play a role in diffusing this, and indeed there was separate incident in the Israeli embassy in Jordan, and the two incidents were linked, and there was an understanding whereby Jordan releases an Israeli security guard who killed a Jordanian in self-defense and killed another bystander. In exchange, Israel removes the measures that were put in place after July 14th. What happened was Israel removed maybe 95% of the measures, left 5%. This 5% became the focal point. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, seeing that he was marginalized, decided to latch onto this 5%, called for escalation. The Israelis, in response, removed the 5%. So the Jordanians felt that their diplomacy was rebuffed, their diplomacy did not produce anything, and the Palestinians claimed credit. And add to that, the security guard, who is seen by many Jordanians as a killer, was then given a hero's welcome in Israel. So the Jordanians are facing their own domestic political problem, and this translated into a major diplomatic problem. This is bad for Israel because the security cooperation with Jordan is key for protecting and helping Israel's security. And it's bad for Jordan because the same security cooperation is also important for Jordan's security. This is a crisis no one wanted, yet both are stuck with it.
Turning back to you, Nathan Sachs, for your interpretation of how this incident that it may have strained relations between Israel and Jordan.
The relationship between Israel and Jordan is in many ways the most normal, the healthiest between Israel and any Arab state. There's peace between Israel and Egypt, and relations with this Egyptian president are good on the security side. But with the Jordanians, there's a long-standing relationship, even before official peace. And Israelis and Americans, too, care very much about the health of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And so in this regard, the Jordanians actually did play a very important role in bringing Israel down from a situation it really should never have arrived at. The decision to put these metal detectors, which seemed benign to Israelis, still seems benign to Israelis, was decided by the police and the minister in charge of the police, but against the advice of most of the security apparatuses. And in slightly different circumstances, it could be quite different. This is another example of this attempt to manage the conflict. Since it cannot be resolved, the parties think they're going to manage it. And in many respects, it's managing them. The slightest thing in Jerusalem can flare up. And it can flare up even with a very important relationship, the Jordanian one. One more point on the context of Jordan. Israel has been looking now for quite a while, and quite enthusiastically, what it sees as a realignment in the region, where several of the important Sunni Arab states, most notably Saudi Arabia, the UAE, but also Jordan and Egypt, find themselves on Israel's side in many important arguments, in particular hostility towards Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran are the main antagonists in much of the Middle East in many different aspects, and of course Israel fears Iran dramatically and vice versa. And so in this regard, Israel sees a realignment of interest that might allow it an opening towards the Sunni Arab states of this camp. Jordan is a member of that. And these kinds of incidents where religious feelings are flared up, where tensions rise even with the Hashemite Kingdom itself and the royal court, These are not helpful for this regional approach and are more evidence of just how volatile the situation is so long as the conflict continues, so long as the sensitivity around Jerusalem and other Palestinian-Israeli issues continues.
We'll talk about that regional realignment in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Reith Alomari, he's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Nathan Sachs, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. We're discussing prospects for ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what role the Trump administration might play in this effort. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Johannes Alfred from Lafia, Nigeria. Thanks for listening, Johannes. And if you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. We'd also like to know what you think of VOA's Encounter and would appreciate it if you took a brief online survey. You can find the survey on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/encounter and select the About tab. Well, back to our program on the Middle East peace process, Israeli-Palestinians, and back to you, Reith Alomari, here in the studio to talk about this so-called realignment, regional realignment about which Nathan Sachs talked before the break. We were talking about some of the Sunni Gulf states, the Saudis, the Jordanians, perhaps other Arab states. Perhaps there's a convergence between them and Israel over Iran, Iran's hegemony in the region, and that convergence, as well as common feelings vis-a-vis the rise of the so-called Islamic State in the region, perhaps that could bring them together and force them to maybe resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
It's working actually in a bifurcated way, in two levels. On one level, as Nathan mentioned, there is ongoing, serious, real, intense military, intelligence, security relations between Israel and Arab states that you talked about, both ones that have peace treaties with Israel, Jordan and Egypt, but also in the Gulf, Saudi, United Arab Emirates, etc. On the military level, this is very healthy and this is very robust. However, this is not translating to the political level and to the open diplomatic level. For the Arab countries, the Palestinian conflict is still a key issue that continues to be able to mobilize the Arab publics. And the Arab countries feel that they cannot have normal peaceful relations with Israel without first resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So this is a conundrum. These Arab countries want to resolve it. They want to deepen the relations with the Israelis. But first, they want to see a resolution of that conflict. Some people talk about having what they call the outside-in approach, where Israel first has peace with the Arab countries and then the Palestinians. I don't believe that can work. However, any peace process right now, for it to succeed, will have to have the Arabs playing a key role, both in terms of providing an incentive for Israel as well as political cover for the Palestinians.
Nathan Sachs, now I want to get your take on this regional realignment and the fact that both Israel and some of the Sunni Gulf Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, UAE, and so forth, have a common enemy in Iran and Iran's rise in the region. But we have this difference over what do you do first? You first resolve Israel-Palestinian, then you cooperate even more on the political level. But I think the Israelis would like to see the reverse, that is the so-called outside in. How do you see it?
You know, for a long time, the Israelis always complained that whenever people talk about the Middle East, they treat the Israeli-Palestinian issue as the core problem of all Middle East issues. In fact, if you talk about Middle East peace process, you mean Israeli-Palestinian. Even though if you know now, look certainly at the region, there are far bigger hot conflicts going on, including next door in Syria with horrific consequences that have nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So from the Israeli perspective, this sort of interest in other issues, finally leaving them alone on the thorny issue of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that, of course, is welcome from their perspective. They think, with some merit perhaps, that many of the Arab leaders are fed up with the Palestinian leadership, are interested in their own national interests as they perceive them, Iran in the case of Saudi Arabia, and other questions of Islamism for other members of this Arab cap. And in that regard, there's a lot of room for cooperation with Israel. The problem, of course, is that the Arab public opinion across the board, A, is very hostile towards Israel, and B, cares deeply about the Palestinian issue, and the Palestinian issue has not been resolved. So there's always this ceiling on the political aspect of how far this can go. We've seen Saudis and others go much further than in the past in open cooperation with Israel. The current Egyptian president is quite open about the security cooperation between Egypt and Israel in ways that in the past, even if they happened, were never public. But nonetheless, there is this political ceiling that it can't break through. And that's for good reason. The Palestinian issue is a very important issue and is extremely important for these publics. I want to say one point about the sort of the regional approach. It is very important, as Gates said, in two respects. First, it can offer political cover for the Palestinians if the custodians of the holy sites, not only in Jerusalem, but in Mecca and Medina and others, grant some kind of political cover to a deal with the Israelis that could facilitate Palestinian movement. And the incentive of normalization with the whole Arab world and at least political acceptance, if not public acceptance, into the region could be enticing for Israelis. But it does not, none of this, addresses the core issues between Israelis and Palestinians. And those core issues are not some mystery. We know what they are. They are very difficult. It is not clear that there is a deal to be had between these two leaders. And even if we package it regionally or internationally or any other way, at the end of the day, Israelis and Palestinians have to agree specifically on whether Jerusalem is redivided and where the border would go and what happens to refugees and their descendants, et cetera, et cetera. And all these issues are not going to be decided in Riyadh. They would have to be decided in Ramallah and Jerusalem.
Well, that's a very good point. And we'll back to you, Ghaith Al-Omari, about these core issues and whether or not there are actually conditions or a climate for peacemaking. It seems that each side is divided. We have Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank still. You have in Israel divisions. Do you see conditions propitious, or have they gotten worse for peace?
The irony and the sad irony when it comes to peace is that in many ways now we know what are the decisions that have to be made about all of these core issues. So the diplomacy side of things maybe is clear. However, as you rightly pointed, the politics in both societies is so divided. And we saw that in full display during this Jerusalem crisis. Netanyahu took decisions that might not have been in the strategic interest of Israel, like he did with Jordan, for example, for the sake of managing his domestic politics. Abbas and his rival Hamas party were both competing who will sound more hardline. Abbas felt that his only way to be legitimate is to seem as more hardline than Hamas. His legitimacy is very low. About 2/3 of the Palestinians want him to resign. Given this political weakness, the ability to make the very complicated, difficult compromises on Jerusalem, on refugees, on borders, on all of these difficult issues is simply not there. So much as diplomatically we have made a lot of progress, I think politically both leaders are too weak and both societies, at least I can speak for about the Palestinian, is so divided that I just simply cannot see these issues being addressed right now.
Natan, with your finger on the pulse of Israeli politics, how do you see this possibility on the Israeli side? Do you see the politics equally divided? We have Bibi Netanyahu, a hawkish prime minister, the settlers backing him, other hardline groups. Are there any alternatives? Do you see any other rising politicians coming in to perhaps break the impasse?
Israeli politics in some ways are a lot simpler than Palestinian. There isn't this gulf, this divide between the two Palestinian territories, and in that respect, it's simpler. The authority of the state is clear, and some things are much easier. But if you look at the Israeli public, and certainly Israeli politicians too on the center-right, there is profound cynicism about the possibility of reaching peace with the Palestinians. If you look at recent polls, there is still a majority, it's getting smaller, but there's still a majority that would favor a two-state solution along the general lines that most international interlocutors think of. But there, for a long time now, and this is true on both the Palestinian and the Israeli side, you see profound skepticism that this could be reached anytime soon, either because the other side doesn't want it or because the other side can't do it or for any other number of reasons. And the result is that the Israelis go through the motions now, and the new American administration wants to have a peace process. The Israelis will certainly have a peace process. But there's almost no one in Israel who takes very seriously the possibility of some dramatic move now with the Palestinians, including those who want it, who genuinely want it, and including those who put more hope on the regional approach. That's not to say that there's nothing to be gained from it. There are many things that could happen in the interim, smaller gains that could be made that are very important. But for a full peace treaty, just like I said on the Palestinian side, it seems quite far-fetched to think that this would happen. I'd be overjoyed if I'm wrong. Is there a possibility of a different kind of government in Israel or a political change? Yes, there certainly is. Israel is a very vibrant democracy. And moreover, Netanyahu himself is facing quite dramatic legal issues. He may possibly be indicted in more than one case involving potentially bribery or other questions of corruption. And this could be quite dramatic. This may spell the end of his reign. We don't know, and he's certainly not done yet. He's been counted out many times, and he's won 4 elections, so don't count him out yet. But he certainly is facing difficulty. That said, it's not like the alternative, just waiting in the wings, is a completely different leader with a completely different approach. The center-right in Israel, hawkish, open to some concessions, open to negotiations, but quite hawkish, is dominant in Israel. Opponents from the center or even the left have a chance, but if I were a betting man, I'd put my money either on Netanyahu himself or on his successors in the center-right from perhaps within his own party, the Likud.
Well, that leads us, gentlemen, to talk about the Trump administration and the desire on behalf of President Donald Trump to jumpstart peace talks through his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who made some offhanded remarks this past week that perhaps cast doubt on whether or not he's willing or able to do that. So let's talk about prospects and what role the United States can and should play, and in particular, this administration could play. How do you see it?
First of all, it's important to point out that 4 previous administrations have tried and have failed. So even if they fail, they would join, you know, a long, respectable line of people who tried. They will not be the first to have failed. With this administration, they have some assets and they have some liabilities. The main asset is the sense in the region that in the last 8 years during President Obama, rightly or wrongly, the region believes that the U.S. has been in retreat and it's been hungry for the U.S. to come back and lead. Many believe that President Trump wants to lead, and we saw this in his visit to the region, in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, and in Israel. The reception he got showed how much the region wanted American leadership, and this gives the U.S. tremendous leverage over all the sides. However, there are a number of liabilities. One relates to the situation on the ground, but the administration itself is still understaffed, too weak, lack of clarity in terms of what the policy is, lack of clarity in terms of who is in charge, lack of staffing. In the Jerusalem crisis, we saw that there was almost no one to talk to in the administration. No one is stepping up. So until the U.S. administration gets its act together, puts its house in order in terms of who's in charge, staffing up, until then, all of this potential that it has for making impact will remain limited.
And you get the last word, Nathan Sachs, on the possibility of a peace deal under President Donald Trump, who waxed very optimistic, saying that he could broker an ultimate deal. Would that be a two-state solution? How do you see the assets and liabilities of the Trump administration vis-a-vis trying to jumpstart peace talks and ultimately broker a deal?
First, like Ray said, coming in with re-engagement or a sense of re-engagement, at least with some of the actors in the Middle East, that's an asset. On this issue in particular, the administration has not been dramatically different from previous ones. We haven't seen dramatically different policies, although during the campaign there was talk of big departures from previous policy. We have not heard a commitment to a two-state solution, but the negotiation on a permanent status agreement with these two parties leaves no other option on the table. There is no really realistic alternative to that anyway. So in theory, they're coming in no worse than previous administrations and perhaps with some advantages. The problem is that no worse than previous administrations is not very good. We're not in a situation where peace is about to break out. And if I were advising the president, I would say that the less one talks about the ultimate deal, the better, because the chances of achieving it are low. What steps in the meantime are done that would last a failure of negotiations? For example, agreements on water that were signed recently, potential agreements on electricity, potentially improving the dire situation in the Gaza Strip, which could flare up into conflict again. All these things might survive the failure of negotiations and would be very good. They won't get anyone a Nobel Peace Prize, but they would improve the lives of real people on the ground. That is an excellent thing. What happens if and when this negotiation fails? Who is blamed? How does the President of the United States react to it? I would strongly caution against taking dramatic steps, A, in declaring failure. One should let it fuzz away and dissipate rather than declare some huge failure. And secondly, one should not jump back to other possibilities, such as moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which was mentioned before. Again, as Ray said, logic doesn't really work in Jerusalem, although I think the U.S. embassy to Israel should, in theory, be in West Jerusalem. Moving it would be a very dangerous move, precisely because of the extreme sensitivity and hyperbole that surrounds the city.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Reith Alomari. He's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Nathan Sachs. He's a fellow in and director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights.
Thank you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Rebecca Ward for her technical assistance. Our engineer was Chang Wong. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.